Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The diagnosis of autism has increased dramatically over the past 40 years. In 1975, it was 1 in 5,000 children who were diagnosed. Today, it's about 1 in 68. So there's no doubt the rate of diagnosis has increased. But has the prevalence? Science writer Steve Silverman says that you have to examine what he calls the forgotten history of autism to know better. He recounts that history and the work of Hans Asperger and Leo Kanner, the clinicians who first noticed autism, but who had vastly different definitions of what constituted autism in his book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Silberman writes that in the late 1930s, Asperger had already had a grasp of what we call the autistic spectrum, but Kanner's work in the United States a little later had a very narrow definition of autism, and that prevailed for decades. Neurotribe also argues against the conventional wisdom that autism is something to be cured of and rather as a disability to offer support for, not a pathology or a result from vaccinations, but a variation of the human genome that with accommodations for learning differences can lead to happy, successful lives for most on the spectrums. Steve Silverman has covered science and cultural affairs for Wired and other national magazines for over 20 years. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Times, Nature, and Salon, and he's the author of Neurotribes and our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Steve Silverman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let me ask you, there's a couple of interesting things and big points that you make in Neurotribes. One is the idea of this neurodiversity, which we can get to a little later, but I want to challenge one of the assumptions that I think you do very successfully in the book, and that is the idea that autism has traditionally been very rare until just the last decade or so of the 20th century, when all sorts of risk factors in the environment has caused a growth in the diagnosis. Why is that perception untrue?
Well, first, let me say that I completely understand why people believe that it is true, because what's certainly true is that the rates of diagnosis and the estimates of autism prevalence really soared in the last decades of the 20th century. So there is no question that the number of diagnoses and the estimates of prevalence have increased. But the question is why? And so what I did for Neurotribes was to go back to really before the dawn of autism history, in a way, and look at the two pioneers of the autism diagnosis. One of them was a guy named Leo Kanner, a child psychiatrist in Baltimore, and the other was a guy named Hans Asperger, a psychologist in Vienna. And I looked at the ways that they conceived of autism, and it turns out that even though they both get credit for discovering it, in fact, Kanner ended up taking virtually sole credit for discovering it, even though Asperger really discovered it first, they had very, very different conceptions of autism. And believe it or not, even though all that stuff happened, in the 1940s, I discovered that the effects of their decisions cascaded down through the decades and sort of arrived in the 1990s as an apparent autism epidemic. And let me just quickly explain why that's so. Hans Asperger, in the 1930s, discovered really what we now call the autism spectrum. It was a condition that was lifelong, lasts from birth to death, requires significant support from parents, teachers, the whole community. You know, it's nothing to make light of. Even though Asperger often gets credit for discovering something called Asperger syndrome, that was actually invented by someone else. What Asperger really discovered was autism as we now understand it to be, a lifelong condition with a very, very broad range of manifestations. So some of the children that Asperger saw were completely disabled. They were basically unable to live on their own without constant care. They could not speak, etc. However, other people with autism that Asperger saw were chatty, older kids, teenagers, and eventually adults, including one of his former patients who was quite impaired originally, ended up becoming an assistant professor of astronomy and loved to talk about his favorite subject. So Asperger had a very wide view of what we now call the autism spectrum. He also believed that autism is very common. He said once you learn to recognize the telltale signs of autism. You see it everywhere. Well, what happened to him? What happened to him was that he was working for Nazis because he was working in Vienna
in
the late 1930s. And so in 1938, the Nazis marched into Austria, annexed it for the German fatherland, took over the hospital that Asperger was working in, and, you know, set about to do all sorts of epically horrible things, like exterminating disabled children. So it turns out that what Asperger was doing by only describing, you know, what are now called sort of high-functioning, although I don't like to use that term, but high, you know, the children who could talk and who could function, he described them to the Nazis so that they wouldn't go after the children who were more disabled in his clinic.
And I think he was holding out a fig leaf that even the far more disabled children could eventually get to that point, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And, you know, he even apparently at one point suggested that autistic people would make good code breakers for the Reich, because he theorized that there was a cluster of abilities, kind of special abilities in autistic people that he called autistic intelligence. And he saw his job as encouraging the growth of autistic intelligence in his patients and, you know, helping them to find their way through the world in a way that would never be typical, quote unquote, but that would allow them to express their potential. So, you know, obviously one of the things that happened during that time period is that Jews had to leave Germany and Austria because they became the target of the Nazis. Well, one of the Jews who left was Hans Asperger's chief diagnostician, a guy named George Frankl. And so George Frankl was rescued, actually, by an American clinician who helped him come over here by saying that he would have a job. And who was that clinician? Leo Kanner. So Leo Kanner at Johns Hopkins Hospital hired George Frankl in 1938. And then shortly after that, Leo Kanner's first autistic patient arrives at Johns Hopkins. Kanner does not know what to make of him, although he was familiar with some of the symptoms that patient, Donald Triplett, probably was manifesting. But Kanner sent Triplett down to George Frankl for evaluation. And in fact, Frankl diagnosed Leo Kanner's first three autistic patients. So in a sense, Kanner had like the expertise of Asperger's own team in Baltimore when he quote-unquote discovered autism. However, Kanner would go on to frame autism very differently. He framed it as, for one thing, an infantile disorder only. He didn't really consider that there could be adult autistics until later in his career. He also theorized disastrously that the source of autism was bad parenting.
Right.
And so-called refrigerator mothers. So that had horrific consequences because the recommended course of treatment for autism became institutionalization. So, you know, oftentimes people say to me, how come I never, you know, saw autistic kids when I was growing up? Like if they're my, you know, I'm a trailing edge baby boomer, as they say. So, yes, you didn't see autistic kids when we were young because either they had no diagnosis at all because the diagnosis didn't become available to Asperger syndrome kids until later, or they were so profoundly affected that they were shut away in institutions and not talked about, and their families, in addition, were blamed for the autism. So it became a source of shame and stigma. So families would not talk about the fact that their children had autism.
Yeah, they would be separated from the families and encouraged not to go visit the kids.
That's exactly true. Yeah. And in fact, there was a sort of a snarky media term for that, parentectomy, because we can laugh about it now, but, you know, it really broke up families. And, you know, I had several parents tell me that they were told by their psychoanalyst to quietly remove their children's pictures from the family albums. And parents would sit on the couch, psychoanalytic couch, for years, you know, perhaps a decade, being told by these Freudian theorists that they hated their children. Why did they hate their children? And, you know, these are people who had already dealt with the significant challenges of raising an autistic child and then the heartbreak of having to put the child in an institution on the doctor's advice. It's completely horrible. And so parts of my book are very, very, very difficult to read, like the parts about the, you know, what the Nazis were doing to disabled children, what psychiatrists were doing to families of autistic children in America in the mid-20th century. But there's also a very redemptive message in the book, one hopes, which is that even many of the kids who were profoundly impaired when they were first diagnosed in the book ended up becoming really beautiful, wonderful adults, like Mark Rimland, who was the one of the original models for Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man, Raymond Babbitt, who was, you know, this completely memorable guy. Anyway, Mark Rimland was one of the real life models, and he was you know, he was self injurious. He would batter his forehead against his crib until he had a bruise, and you know, he was very, very rough to bring up in the first years of his life. But by the time I met him and spent a couple days with him, he was a very happy, sweet, middle-aged guy, an athlete. He'd won medals in Special Olympics. He was, the night I was in San Diego visiting him, he was giving an art exhibit at a gallery, and, you know, still very autistic, still very eccentric, but he had a community of people who love him and support him just the way he is. And, you know, that's a wonderful thing.
And that gets to the second big notion in your book, Neurotribes, the idea that autism, and it's something I think that Hans Asperger knew from the very beginning, and like his idea of the spectrum, which sort of got lost for about 40 or 50 years, the idea that autism is a lifelong disability that deserves support rather than a disease of children to be cured.
Yeah, here's the thing. You know, we've spent the last 15 years or so in America doing two things: arguing about whether or not vaccines cause autism, and focusing all of our efforts as a society, i.e. research money, on discovering the causes of autism. So, you know, even people who know that vaccines don't cause autism, you know, think that the most important question to ask is, what is the risk factor in the environment that causes autism? And, you know, thus far we've compiled a sort of an endlessly expanding list of potential risk factors. You know, is it air pollution? Is it antidepressants in the water supply? Is it Wi-Fi? Is it video games? Like, all these things have been seriously proposed, some of them, you know, more likely as potential risk factors than others. I think the question we should be asking as a society is, how can we help autistic people and their families live happier, healthier, more secure, and safer lives? Because parents are terrified that they'll die before their kids have, you know, are able to live independently. And autistic people are facing very, very difficult financial circumstances often. Many of them are unemployed. And it's not because they can't work or don't want to work. It's because, you know, what are human resources departments looking for? You know, people with social skills. Well, you know, a lot of autistic people struggle with real-time social interactions, parsing body language and tone of voice. You know, the thing, autistic people are generally not good people. They're good at what they do. They're good at intense focus and, you know, finding flaws in visual patterns. And there are many, many different skills associated with what Asperger called autistic intelligence, and we're basically not using it as a society. We're excluding those people because they don't know how to play the social games that we all know how to play.
Right.
So I think that for us to take autism seriously, we have to be benefiting autistic people, not just benefiting academic scientists who, yes, they're doing very interesting work. Many of them are my friends. But, you know, are we really, as a society, helping autistic people and their families? And I think, as of yet, the answer is no.
My guest today is Steve Silberman, a science journalist and the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. It's published by Avery. And in the book, Steve, you use the story of a Silicon Valley family, the story of the Roses. Sort of gives us a good sense of the journey they went on with their son, Leo, to kind of come to that idea that autism is a lifelong disability. I think they went through every possible treatment, every possible clinical situation, trying to find something that would work for their son Leo, until they finally came to this idea that instead of trying to cure it, we need to view it, autism, as a disability so that Leo could get the support to thrive.
That's exactly true. They are a beautiful family, I have to say. They're a wonderful family. And they have been through sort of everything, like every stage of evolution in the autism community. Leo is, I don't want to call him nonverbal, because he does use phrases that he likes. But, he does not have a very large vocabulary. And when I met him, he was still struggling with learning basic skills to take care of himself. And he, had some problems with aggressive behavior. Leo needs a lot of help. He's one of those people who doesn't seem like Bill Gates necessarily. You know, he's a kid who struggles with a lot of daily, very real needs. And that's a lot of autistic kids. And the situation of the Roses, resembles that of many, many families of children with autism. So Shannon and her husband, Craig, are science geeks. And so when Leo was diagnosed, for one thing, they read a bunch of stuff online by, sort of at the height of the anti-vaccine panic. They read a lot of stuff online that suggested that their lives as a family would be miserable, that Leo had no potential, that he had been brain injured by a vaccine, and that all they could do is rage against this conspiracy, alleged conspiracy conducted by Big Pharma. And Shannon is a very outspoken person. She had a blog. She would rage against the pharmaceutical companies for allegedly covering up the ill effects of vaccines. Not only that, they committed every possible family resource towards, towards what Shannon used to call on her blog, her soon-to-be non-autistic boy. So they put him through dietary interventions, very elaborate diet. In fact, they tended to get more elaborate as time went on. A lot of so-called biomedical treatments, drugs that are not necessarily approved by the FDA, but they're sold as dietary supplements. Also some, alternative medical modalities that are popular.
It read like was a lot of charlatans, really.
Well, yes. And the truth of the matter is that one of the most dangerous things about being the parent of an autistic kid is that you suddenly become sort of the target demographic for a ton of charlatans selling everything. Every week there's some new product that allegedly cures autism. I mean, people don't use the word cure much because it's so loaded, but they'll say recovers. By the way, some kids who, quote-unquote, lose their diagnosis, that's very possible, because the autism diagnosis is not made on the basis of a blood test or a brain scan or any other kind of biomarker. It's an observation of behavior. So if the kid's behavior develops to the point where they can get through a clinical evaluation without triggering the diagnosis, basically, the parent can say that their kid has recovered. But does that mean that the child does not need any more support? Absolutely not, because some of these kids are later diagnosed with ADHD or depression or chronic anxiety. So in other words, the same things that we need to do for kids who don't lose their diagnosis, we need to think about for kids who do.
Well, I was going to say, one of the reasons that those kids maybe do pass of this evaluation is because they've developed coping mechanisms. And in the story of Leo, you tell already he's in his own way developing some coping mechanisms, where he'll have some word cues that sort of keep him from, whether it's jumping on the bed and of course he has his stimulus, which in his cases are purple straws.
Green
straws from Starbucks.
Yep. No, you're so right. That is very insightful, I have to say, and that's exactly true. And in fact, I started my book 5 years ago I forget when in the process that I met the Roses, but Leo has actually developed quite a bit since the time that I met him. And, you know, one of the worst things about the era of institutionalization was that parents were told that their kids would not develop at all, that autism was a fate worse than death. Well, it turns out that institutionalization in a state hospital, where the kids were often put on a ward for adult psychotics, that was a fate worse than death for an autistic kid. And, you know, the kids did not develop and did not learn and would often become extremely self-injurious because they were subjected to extremely brutal behavior. So anyway, Leo is doing great. He's a super handsome teenager now, and, you know, he's, in his own way, he's very social. It's just that, and he's very, very sweet. Like, you know, when I visit the Roses, he'll come up to me and just sort of rest his head on my shoulder or start tickling my elbow or whatever. He's very, very sweet. But when I first met him, like when the world of medicine first met autistic people in the 1940s, I assumed that he was, you know, kind of shut off in his own world and not even aware of me and all that, you know. But after spending a couple days with him, when I thought he was completely unaware of me, he just came up to me and gave me a big hug one day, and that was kind of my initiation. But so the Roses went through the whole dog and pony show, basically. Many parents, I mean, it's hard enough being able to afford, you know, things like an education or being able to afford just the health needs of autistic kids. And so, you know, many, many parents are spending thousands of dollars a month on these kind of gray market, you know, alleged treatments. And, you know, if a parent thinks that a treatment has done wonders for their child, that's great. You know, I think it's wonderful. But I think as a society that we have to deal with the fact that these kids are not going away, that they're not going to be all recovered overnight or something, and that we have to start making plans for their future.
The other big idea that's in this book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, written by my guest, Steve Silberman, is the idea that maybe we should think of the neurological differences like autism or dyslexia and ADHD not as a sign of pathology, but a variation in the human genome. And this comes up with this term, neurodiversity. What do we mean by neurodiversity?
Well, the shortest explanation of neurodiversity that I've heard is great minds don't necessarily think alike, which is to say that people with dyslexia, autism, ADHD, and other conditions that are, you know, basically medical diagnoses have contributed greatly to our society. One of the people who invented the technology that was really became the modern computer was so dyslexic that he jumped out of a school window when the teacher tried to teach him to read. Basically, one of the first characters in my book that you meet is a guy named Henry Cavendish, who was a very early scientist. In fact, so early that the word scientist hadn't even been invented yet. He was a guy who lived in England in the last years of the 18th century, and his peers did not know what to make of him. Every single day, he took a walk along exactly the same route at the same time. Every single meal, he ate basically the same thing, leg of mutton. Every day, he wore the same clothes, and when they would wear out, he would have a tailor make an identical outfit. He could hardly talk to people. He would panic if he was in, you know, like a crowded room. He did not like to look people in the eye. He liked to stand off to the side and sort of eavesdrop on what they were saying. But he was one of the most brilliant scientists of his time. And in fact, even using that word does not do justice to him, because he didn't just do science. He invented fields of science. So the first chapter of my book is about this guy who was considered completely bizarre and profoundly impaired by his peers, but was also respected as one of the finest scientists alive in his era. And he developed coping strategies too, and he was only able to do so because he came from a wealthy family. If he had not come from a wealthy family, he probably would have been put in the hospital that was called Bedlam at the time.
Yeah.
For, you know. And so one of the arguments that my book makes is that instead of looking at these conditions that are all relatively common, there are a lot of people with dyslexia in the world. There are a lot of people with autism in the world, various shades of it. There are a lot of people with ADHD in the world. So what can we do as a society to become open to the contributions that they want to make to the evolution of culture and science and technology? So I think we can do that as a society and end up stronger.
One of the things that it obviously means is major changes in the way we educate our young.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things that would be helpful is if we paid teachers more, frankly. You know, we treat teaching as this second-tier, you know, custodial service, you know, those who can't do teach. That's wrong. Teachers are like the most important people in our society, practically, because they're bringing up the next generation and setting them on the course that they will pursue through life. And we also need to make teachers more aware of the needs of, you know, these various neurotribes, you could call them. I mean, that's, I actually don't, one of the funny things about my book is I actually don't use the word in the book, except as a title. But, you know, that's what I'm talking about, is that, you know, people with dyslexia are, in a sense, a tribe. And so we can now, using digital technology, customize lesson plans in ways for, say, students who are strong visual learners or strong auditory learners. We can teach the same curriculum, but in ways that are customized for the strengths of each individual student. And so instead of thinking of these people as, you know, just checklists of deficits, which is often what comes up in the, you know, any parent of an autistic kid knows what an IEP is, an individualized education plan. And IEP meetings are often like basically recitations of the deficits and impairments that a kid has. They should also include the strengths and interests that a kid has, so that the, you know, so that the education can be customized for what makes the kid thrive and be happy, because it feels good to do what you're good at doing. Mark Rimlin, that guy that I was talking about before, who was the model for Rain Man, the tipping point in his upbringing, you know, because his parents were so disturbed by his autistic behavior and his self-injurious behavior, that they mostly focused on what he couldn't do for years and years. But the tipping point was when one of his art teachers at a special school that he went to encouraged him to make a drawing of an eagle, and it turned out to be beautiful. And he brought it home that day, and his mother, Gloria, was like, "Where did you get that?" And he said, "I'm an artist now." And from that point on, he knew he was good at something. And so he started to think of himself as a capable person instead of sort of a mess, you know, of things that he couldn't do. And so it's really important that we support kids by allowing them to find what they're good at. And that's something that Asperger knew as far back as 1938.
Oh, really interesting book, Neurotribes. Steve Silberman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Science journalist Steve Silberman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. It's published by Avery. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.